I'd like to have permission to be postmodern, but I'm not sure who to ask. It all began, or my part in this story began, when my editor wrote a note on my manuscript saying, "You'll have to get permission for all these quotes." Although I suppose it really began when I naively wrote my book and put all the quotes in the first place. Or maybe it began that day back just before I was born when my father walked into the house carrying a brand new television. Of course, in some people's reckoning, it began when America dropped the bomb on Hiroshima. Anyway, I'm part of a certain kind of a world and I write in a certain kind of way. My book, How to Conceive of a Girl, incorporates lots of little narratives, outside texts, within its wider narratives. Everything from all the stories and anecdotes that people have told me, to bits from The Donahue Show, The Bible, In Bed with Madonna, books on infertility and birth, lines from popular songs, gossip items from New Idea, and so on. I'm definitely a magpie, but I seem to have a taste for the space junk left lying around out there. Mostly things produced originally for an entirely different purpose. In general, I don't pick my bits out of someone else's nest, but off the street, or in supermarkets, or I dig around in rubbish dumps. I don't know how I suddenly became convinced that I had to get permission for everything, or I was going to get sued. I suppose I got conservative legal advice the first time around. There are so many rumours out there. It's such a grey area. I also knew that my own publisher had been sued the year before, that it had cost them probably more than I'll ever make from this book, and that with the proliferation of multimedia, everyone was clamping down on this kind of thing and becoming very serious about it. So there I am, 10 hours a day on the phone, drafting letters and searching back through boxes of notes, doing what I now see as crazy things, like trying to track down the records of the now-defunct Sunday Observer so I can get the name of the journalist, no byline, so probably from the US, who wrote a piece on Linda Carter back in 1980, which some wonderful sub-editor had headed, "I Want a Baby, Confessions of Wonder Woman." How can I presume to make these things up when they're so perfect already? Then I'd used 25 words from Agatha Christie, and 43 words from a philosophy text, and that story within the story that I'd rewritten from memory from a 1960s Reader's Digest omnibus. And just tracking down who holds the rights for a particular song can cost $50, so I join a Lou Reed mailing list on the internet and get inundated with email from fans listing every song in the order he sung them for every concert on his tour, and learn to refer to him as Lou, or the man. And eventually, after a few wild goose chases, I find out that Pale Blue Eyes is administered by EMI. Ah, it was EMI that sued my publisher. You see, all this time I'm busily scratching around after these motes, I guess what I'm desperately trying to ignore are a few rather large and uncomfortable logs. The first is I've made 7 references to particular recordings of songs in my book, albeit brief. But ask any music publishing company and they will act aghast at the idea that you could use any word or phrase from a song without permission. Fees are determined by the company, but $250 and upwards is pretty standard. Add that up, and 7 tiny references, and oh how merrily I netted them in, could end up as a bill for perhaps thousands of dollars. And then the nice young woman from Marie Claire in England, "Oh, your book sounds wonderful." Once I explain, on an expensive telephone call late at night, that from an article syndicated to Cosmopolitan 4 years ago, I'm only using 80 words that aren't actually on the public record, she says, "Oh, in that case, it will just be a token fee of £50. I see. And so, fortunately, it's around about this time that I pause before I post out my 2 dozen letters seeking permissions. What if even a proportion of these want to charge token fees? And then on the other log that I could see, in my fitful, nightmare-filled sleep, especially if I had to set the alarm to ring Lou in New York at some ungodly hour, sweeping down the river towards me. Well, there were 2 of them, kind of tied together. And sitting up there on the first, with an expression on his face that I couldn't quite make out, was the ghost of J.M. Barrie. In a novella which is about a third of the book, I've used the occasional brief quote from Peter Pan as a structuring principle, little typographical stepping stones. Except that my Peter is a girl, which means that even when the quotes stay the same, in the context of a story exploring being childless, either by choice or otherwise, and cultural notions of femininity and adulthood, they take on very different meanings from the original. For instance, "If you find yourself mothers," Peter said darkly, "I hope you will like it." The awful cynicism of this made an uncomfortable impression, and most of them began to look rather doubtful. The quotes are less than 400 words out of 20,000, and I actually feel that Mr. Barry himself would approve. But he's dead, and it would be some unknown person who administers the estate making the decision. What if they, just personally, didn't happen to like what I was doing? And on the other log, a whole heap of people from Fatal Attraction, barreling down on me for a story in which I've not just quoted dialogue from the film, but have appropriated the main characters and actors and sent them off on a mission around the back streets of Newtown. But can I realistically ask James Dearden and Adrian Lyne for permission to critique their film in the way I have in this story? It's not exactly a flattering view. So, it was at around about this point that some of the people I was seeking advice from, such as the Australian Society of Authors, began to see that maybe I wasn't just a criminal-minded anarchist postmodernist who wanted to be able to rip off other people's words without paying for them, that maybe my rights as a writer also needed defending here, and that this isn't just a simple black-and-white copyright issue, but is also about free speech. I can't write the way I do if I have to pay everyone a tithe. And I'm not just talking lots of little sums. Macmillan in the UK wanted $500 for every print run for a few brief quotes and paraphrases from a 1970s book about fairies. And EMI originally asked for $830 for 11 words from Pale Blue Eyes. And I can't keep writing this way if anyone who doesn't like what I've said or implied about their work has the right to refuse to allow me to quote from it. The simple answer is, well, the clause within the Copyright Act that allows for fair usage of another's work for the purposes of criticism, research or review. But this is a book of fiction. Can I rely on getting a judge who understands that fiction can sometimes also be criticism? Besides, most of these things aren't decided by judges anyway, because they rarely get to court. Music publishing companies realised this a long time ago, that it's whoever's got the biggest team of lawyers and the most money that, in effect, get to set the laws. For a long time, their interpretation, that even using one line of a song constitutes a copyright violation, has been accepted as fact. Even though, to my knowledge, this has never actually been tested in the courts, and it's certainly not the advice I eventually received from the Australian Copyright Council. In other words, if publishers tend to settle out of court, and who can blame them, it becomes irrelevant whether my use is legal or not. And it's certainly irrelevant whether it's ethical or not. Let me stress that I fundamentally support the principle of copyright protection for authors, that is, the principle of asking for permission to reproduce substantial pieces of another's work and the need to compensate artists for any loss of sales this might involve, or for their original labour in producing the work. Effectively, so they can go on producing more work, which is what we all want. But I also believe that writers need to be able to imaginatively, creatively, and productively engage with the cultural products and contemporary cultural events around them. I can't see that it's in anyone's interest, least of all other artists and musicians, for us to be forced to keep writing books as if music, television, films, and magazines don't exist or have important effects in the world or on people's lives and feelings. I also don't see that, given the nature of contemporary culture, it's particularly useful or even possible to make a distinction between those who appropriate and those who don't. What might be more useful is to look at the effects and implications of the myriad kinds of borrowings that do go on, the ethics, if you like, or the politics. However, sometimes I wonder if the more ethical I try to be, the more potentially actionable I might be making myself in the long run. More than once I received the helpful advice, don't acknowledge it. Don't identify the source. Shuffle the words around a little bit. Whatever you do, don't write and let them know. In other words, steal it. And I guess this is my concern, that if we have an inflexibly rigid attitude to the use of other people's words, then we are encouraging a climate in which people steal rather than borrow, pilfer rather than critique, or where the jokes become merely private. There seems to be this idea out there that appropriation is easy. A bit like the old idea that free verse in poetry is easy. If you don't have to rhyme, well hey, where's the talent in that? But if you are concerned with attribution and sourcing and referencing, with evoking the original context and maintaining the integrity of the fragment even in its new context, with a whole range of ethical and political issues, as well as trying to sew the whole thing together into some kind of compelling narrative, with preserving a multiplicity of original voices and yet still taking some kind of final authorial responsibility for what you're doing, it's actually quite complex and takes a lot of thought and a lot of repetitive, painstaking labour and imagination. I prefer to think of myself as a collaborator or cultural partner, not a thief. In fact, without exception, every author I've been able to directly contact has been delighted that I've used their work and has wished me every success. And this includes the man himself, who instructed EMI to drop the fee to $130 after I wrote him a letter raising these kinds of concerns. You see, lifting something can be exactly that. It doesn't have to be exploitative. As Eudora Welty once put it, criticism can be an art too. It can pick up a story and waltz with it.